this section, Jesus forms a covenant community of those who are learning to believe and coming to understand. The main focus of this section is on Jesus and on how his disciples gradually came to put words on him, to know him, to find from their tradition language to express what they saw him to be. We've already seen, I won't go over it now, the references are there if you want to look at them, we've seen Jesus spoken of as the suffering servant, going back to the songs in the Isaiah scroll. We've already seen him called the Son of Man, the one who is, very simply putting it and not adequately, but the one who shows what God's judgment is like, what it looks like in this world. Very different from John the Baptist's image or that of the scribes and Pharisees. We've already seen Jesus called the physician, the healer, and the bridegroom. Now, in this section, we're going to see him called I've used the word builder, carpenter is what we're more familiar with, but technon in the Greek is more than, it includes carpentry, but it's a general word for a builder. So he's called the builder's son. Everyone knew Joseph in Nazareth, and this is his son. He's going to be shown, and this is one of the most dramatic scenes, he's going to be shown to be the second Moses. Moses fed, or God fed the people on manna on their journey through the desert. It was God who dried up the Red Sea so they could cross it. Well, here you're going to see it in these two most powerful scenes, the manna, the multiplication of the loaves, and Jesus walking on the water. He's going to be called, in chapter 14, the Son of God, the Saviour, the Son of David, the Messiah, the Son of the Living God, that's what Peter calls him at Caesarea Philippi, and the Son of Man who's suffering now with those who suffer, but who's vindicated by God, as was the Son of Man in the Daniel vision in the night. He will take to himself all who've listened to him and all who've lived as he lives. He's called the beloved Son of God, with whom God is well pleased. That's on the mountain of Tabor. The disciples are told, we're told, listen to him. So let's begin. Chapter 13, verse 54. Jesus came to his hometown, and he began to teach the people in their synagogue, so that they were astounded, and they said, where did the man get this wisdom and these deeds of power, this miraculous power? Isn't this the builder's son? Isn't his mother called Mary or Mariam? Are not his brothers, and they're named, James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas? Aren't they his brothers? Aren't his sisters here with us? This is in Nazareth. Where did he get all this? And they took offence at him. He was so ordinary, he was one of them. They remembered him and they remembered his family. The family it's a bit tricky because we're not given a lot of evidence. The earliest tradition in the church was that Jesus was Mary's only son. And that's the way I grew up too, and you grew up, and it's quite likely right. But it's not exactly tied down. And the problem is, as you probably know, I'll tell you through a story if I may, because it brought it home to me. I went up years ago to Papua New Guinea where my one of my a brother who was 10 years ahead of me was the priest there with the people, and I was going up there to give a retreat to the missionaries. And I went to his village, and he took me out to see, my memory is there was about a dozen people in the group. And he said, "Oh, this is my brother Michael." And somebody said, "Same father, same mother?" Because brother didn't tell them enough precision. And he said, "Yes." Oh, well, they were quite excited because they loved him, of course. So I got a bit of the radiance of that, having the same mother. Because you can be a brother without the same mother and same father. It's a general word for a boy in this generation, this extended family. And same with girl, sister. So it's likely that the man mentioned here as James is the James who became the leader of the church in the Acts of the Apostles and who wrote the letter from James. Could well be him. He's called the brother of the Lord, for obvious reasons. We don't hear any more about Joseph, this Joseph, named after his dad, no doubt. And Simon and Judas are two of the apostles mentioned in the 12. And there's a letter attributed to Jude as well, or Judas, same word. So there it is. He's one of us. So what's he doing? You know, Jesus said to them, "Prophets aren't without honour except in their own country and in their own house." And Matthew puts it, not as strongly as Mark, unfortunately, but Matthew says, Jesus didn't do many miracles there because of their unbelief. Jesus was not a magician. He wasn't. His love needed a welcome, the welcome of faith that we've talked about. And because they didn't believe, wonderful things didn't happen. Rarely happened. Mark, and Matthew would be familiar with this, says more strongly, Jesus couldn't do any miracles there because of their lack of faith. The main point is the same, of course, but it was so amazing. But then Mark says, though he did heal a few people. And I remember looking at that for years, trying to think, well, that'll do me for a miracle if he healed people. But the point being made by Mark, and that therefore by Peter in the writing of the Mark's Gospel, is no, for a miracle to happen, it has to be something wonderful, of course, but it also has to be a sign. It has to be something that points people to God. And why Jesus healed people, because he couldn't stop himself, it didn't point them towards God. So it's not technically a miracle. There's a story here of Herod and the dance, and you know it pretty well, I'm sure. And Herod promises I'll call her wife, the woman he's with anyhow, her daughter, even half my kingdom you can have. And he's sorry, he made that boast, be so embarrassed, because she goes out, her mother tells her to ask for the head of John the Baptist. So she does. And Herod has John the Baptist's head beheaded, and then gives her that thing. The bit I want to point you to, I won't read the story again, I've just said it. It's in blue at the bottom there. Had John beheaded in prison. The head was brought up on a platter and given to the girl who brought it to her mother. This is the point. His disciples came and took the body and buried it. Then they went and told Jesus. The reason given by Matthew for Jesus wanting to go off into a deserted place was to grieve over this beautiful John the Baptist who'd been murdered. And also the looming in Jesus' mind is, well, if they did it to John the Baptist, they'll probably do it to me too. And his time is limited. When Jesus heard about this murder, he withdrew from there in a boat alone to a deserted place. When the crowds heard it, they followed him by land from the cities, and when he got out, he saw a large crowd. So he went away to mourn. He went away just with his intimate friends. In Mark's gospel, the reason he goes away is they've been on their first mission and they come back very excited. See, each gospel has its own truth to share. They're not all repeating each other. And in that gospel, in Mark's gospel, because they come back and they're all excited, etc., and Jesus says, oh, come on. So he wants to take them away. You'd expect to teach them about mission and what to be excited about and what not. But here in Matthew, it's Jesus is going away with a heavy heart to be alone with his friends. But he sees the crowd and he had compassion for them. That's that splunkna word again that we talked about. His knotting of like it's real pain for Jesus to see these people in such need. So he puts his own need for mourning and silence and whatever with his, he puts that aside and he cures the sick. I'm now going to take you to these two amazing scenes, and I hope I can do it well with you. The two scenes are, they're united, it's one whole picture. The multiplication of the loaves, the feeding of the 5,000, followed by Jesus walking on the water. They're the two scenes. What are we dealing with here? Are we dealing with remembered events? Well, of course they'd be remembered because they're so dramatically powerful, who'd forget them? Is that what we're dealing with? Perhaps. But there are questions that I find myself asking about that way of reading them. First question is, well, what's the point, really? Is Jesus unlike us in that? He can multiply bread and fish, and we can't. Does that make him different from us, even though we've been led to believe he's like us in everything except sin? Well, this isn't being like us, so that's at least a hesitation that you might share. The other thing is it doesn't happen again. Like, we don't do that. When people are starving, we call on the United Nations, we do what we can, but we don't. Christians aren't around multiplying bread and fish. So, okay, so it's a one-off thing. And then we ask, or I ask, and you might like to ask with me, is that how God acts in the world, by finding people who are hungry and feeding them? Well, I think the answer to that is an abrupt no. Everyone we know that's starving, and they're starving in their millions because of our systems of trade and all the rest of it that you know a lot about, God doesn't intervene and feed them. If we don't feed them, they're not fed. So what are we expecting of God from these two scenes? Jesus walked on water. We don't. Are we meant to, as his disciples? Is he like us, except that he can walk on water and we can't? Because it doesn't prove his divinity. It's got nothing to do with divinity. His divinity is apparent all the way through the gospel. It's his intimate communion with God. His sharing in God's life, the spirit that they share. That's his divinity. So what's it about? Well, I suggest it's about Matthew has been presenting scenes, remembered scenes, quite a few of them now, of healing mostly, loving, welcoming, inviting into the community, all of that. And that's wonderful, and we should still be doing that, and he's still doing it through us. What we've got here, I think, are two powerfully dramatic scenes. There's a change. It's a gospel. We're watching it closely, and there are two incredibly marvelous dramas. as the church tells us, they're not just about what Jesus, the Gospels aren't just about what Jesus said and did. Well, this is a dramatic scene to help us get to the centre of what he's doing and saying, get to the point of it. And then we think, well, these two scenes go right back to the book of Exodus. And there are I'm going to read some for you. Many bits of music from the Psalms that are picked up in this scene. It's full of music and memory and art and music, all there to help create this amazing drama. And the drama is about the truth of who Jesus is and about what he did. It's not the facts, it's the truth. And the two big scenes, of course, are the crossing of the Red Sea. They went through across the Red Sea dry shod, so they can walk on water, as it were. And then the years when they were fed in the desert by the manna. They're referred to in these two scenes. But they're the two big events. They're reversed, actually, in Mark and now in Matthew, who's following Mark. They're reversed because the crossing comes after the multiplication. I think what they're saying is it's the big story of Israel, the myths and legends and the way it's been all expressed, reversed, because we can't walk on water unless we've been fed by Jesus. The manna comes first. It enables us to do what our ancestors did centuries ago and cross the Red Sea to freedom. So let's have a look then and see if you can, how you can hear. I'll do my best to present the scenes as they are, but the colour is important. And I'm suggesting to you for a moment just to imagine these as two dramatic inputs so that we don't miss the point of all the scenes where we're watching Jesus. It was evening, says Matthew. The disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place. The hour is now late. The crowd, send them away so that they can go to the villages and buy food for themselves." Very thoughtful. And here's the main line in this scene. Jesus said to them, "You give them something to eat yourself. You do it." I remember a woman said, told me this story years ago. She was told by an MSC priest, in fact. She'd lost her husband, had to bring up her three children, and she told me this story. The priest said to her, and he named her, I won't. He said, "If someone asks you to do something, they want you to do it." And she lived on that for the rest of her long life. And there's a beautiful truth in it. It doesn't mean we don't refer to someone more competent than us to help the person. We're not denying that. But you know what it's like if I ever get the courage to go to somebody and ask for help. That's a bit of a journey. Excuse me. And you've gone on a long journey. At least the person you ask, you must have chosen them out. You must have sought them out. You must have had reasons. So that person, and let that be you now, when someone comes to you or me, you do what you can. Like, refer them if you need to, of course, but don't refer them without embracing them, as it were, without showing you care and listening and offering whatever help you possibly can. So Jesus says, the disciples are sensible. Send them away. We're going to find out there's 5,000 men, not counting the women and kids, so we've got 20,000 people in this crowd. Well, send them away because, look, the shops will be shut soon. And Jesus says, no, you give them something. And they reply, as we would reply and do reply in our life, we haven't got the resources to feed these people. You know that, Jesus. All we've got is 5 loaves and 2 fish. And beautiful drama. Jesus says, bring what you've got to me, to him. This is what we do in the Mass all the time, by the way. We bring our poor little gifts of bread, if it is bread. It looks, doesn't look like it, but in the end we'll call it bread. And wine, we bring them to Jesus. So they're brought to the altar, to Jesus. And then Jesus ordered the crowd to sit on the grass, and you can find allusions in the book of Exodus to that. He took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish. He looked up to heaven and blessed. He praised God. Eulogy, same word again, we've had it a few times. He looked, so this is about God. He looked to heaven and blessed, and Jesus broke the loaves and he gave them to his disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowd. Now this is going to go on forever. This is, and we're not multiplying loaves in that literal sense, but the church is still all about this, is giving any one of us, giving to others whatever God has enabled us to give. But we've got to take our gifts, your gifts, my gifts, we've got to take them to Jesus, because the miracle happens in his hands. It doesn't happen out there with bubbling of fish and stuff out of the baskets, which is the way it's usually done from Hollywood. No, Andrew, for example, comes up with a few fish and a bit of this and to Jesus, and he says, look, this is all we've got. And Jesus holds it, prays, and gives it back to Andrew. Just the same things that Andrew gave him, but now they're different. And he gives them to the first few people in the crowd. What's he got to do next? He's got to go back to Jesus and receive another fish and bread. And it never runs out, because it's coming from the risen Christ into the community of his disciples. We're told everybody ate and were filled. They took up what was left over of the broken pieces, 12 baskets full. There are 12 apostles, 12, enough for everybody, and they're full. So we're obviously meant to go on and do what Jesus did, not literally multiply loaves out of whatever, but the eternal and infinite gifts that God has come through us. And all you people know, this is what love is like. If you give all your, I'll take you, you're a married person with family, you give all your love to your first baby, of course you do. But then when the second baby comes, you give all your love to the second baby. Because love doesn't run out. It's not confined. And to the third and whatever. And if you're a teacher, you give all your love to the class you're in. But it doesn't take anything away. You go to the next classroom and you give all your love to those kids. And so it goes on. Love doesn't run out, because God is love. Obviously, you've seen this without me showing you. The language is identical with Matthew's account of the Last Supper. So you're meant to think of the Last Supper as well as all these other images of manna in the desert and so on. Look at the Last Supper. Taking a loaf of bread, same verb, same noun. Blessing, same verb. Broke it, same. And gave it to his disciples. So the literature is echoing all the time, ringing bells all the time about the Eucharist, which is meant to ritualize what this gospel is about. We say at once, and do this in memory of me, you know those words that the priest reads on your behalf just after the consecration. Do what? do this in memory of me. He doesn't mean turn up next Saturday night to Mass. That's not excluded. In fact, that's part of it. But what he wants us to do is what he's doing, namely giving his broken body and his poured out love to the community. And he wants you to do that too. And when we say amen, we promise to do it. Do what I'm doing. Give your life in love. And if it means crucifixion, well, I'm sorry, but that's what it means. But there's a resurrection. Now some texts from the Old Testament, just to that echo. They were so familiar with the Old Testament, the people reading this, of course, and perhaps we are too. You can hear all this in that scene. I'll read it to you. Isaiah 55. Why do you spend money on what is not bread? Your labour for that which doesn't satisfy you. Listen carefully to me. Eat what's good. Delight yourself in rich food. Incline your ear. Come to me. The rich food, of course, is what God is saying in your heart to you now. That's the rich food. When we're not actually talking about matter here, it's all we are, but it's there's a lot more to it. Incline your ear. Come to me. Listen. Why? So that you may live. I'll make of you an everlasting covenant. Here's 2 Corinthians 9, verse 8. God is able to provide you, says Paul, with every blessing in abundance, multiplication, so that by always having enough of everything, you may share abundantly in every good work. That's what this scene, another thing that this scene is about. Apart from me, says Jesus, you can do nothing. So I can't do what that scene's about. You can't do it. We've got little gifts. Not much, but we've got what we've got. And they can work if, as Jesus says, bring your gifts to me, to him. And now the second scene, which is connected. It's just one scene, really. Excuse me. Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up the mountain by himself to pray. This is what he went there for when he heard of John the Baptist's death. He went up to be alone with God. When evening came, he was there alone. And as we read that scene, we're also thinking of Jesus leaving us in the death, the burial, the resurrection, ascension. He's with God. He's in heaven. He's on the mountain alone in prayer. But he's very connected to us. So there's some feel of that in this as well. By this time, Matthew adds, the boat, battered by the waves, was far from land, for the wind was against them. In the fourth watch of the night, this is life, we all know this. If God's going to come and answer your prayer, well, the first watch of the night, of course, is from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., from sunset, effectively, till halfway to midnight. The second watch takes us to midnight, the deepest. The third watch takes us to 3 a.m. The fourth watch is just as dawn is about to come. So the dawn coming and Jesus coming mysteriously are the same. So this is the dark night of the soul, perhaps not always, but perhaps a long time of suffering, a long time of bewilderment. We've got to hold him there because he is coming. Back to our text. In the fourth watch of the night, Jesus came walking towards them on the sea. When the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were, this is a drama. This is happening on stage. You're enjoying it, I hope. When the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were afraid and they said, "It's a ghost." And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus said to them, "Take heart." Courage, same word, core in his heart. "Take heart. It is I." Well, "it is I," it's a pity really. The Greek is so clear, it's ego eimi, I am. Now that has echoes. I am. Go back to the book of Exodus and go back to Moses asking God, "Who are you? Give me your name so that I can go back to Egypt and say, the God of the mountain sent me, or the God of whatever, Midian or what. Tell me who you are." And God says, "Look, Moses, I can't tell you who I am. A name's not going to solve anything. You can't pin me down and name me and then put me aside and get on with the next bit. No, I am. This is Yahweh, the name," which is not a name really. It's the God who, "I will be with you. You have to trust me. You can't name me. You can't pin me down. But if you go, I'll be there." In fact, Jesus is going to say this himself at the Last Supper. After I've gone, he says, "Go into Galilee and I'll meet you there. Continue your journey. I'll be there wherever you go. But you'll have to trust me." So here's Jesus saying, Yahweh, the Redeemer God, the redemption from Egypt, inverted commas, journey, crossing the Red Sea, manna in the desert, God sustaining them, and then entrance into the promised land. You can see all the parallels along there, I'm sure. Go back to the old text and hear this music coming in as the scene you're watching, this amazingly dramatic scene. "Thus says Yahweh," this is Isaiah 43, "He who created you, O Jacob, the one who formed you, O Israel, don't fear. I have redeemed you. I've called you by name. You are mine." Look at this. "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they won't overwhelm you, because I'm there with you." Isaiah 51, "Was it not you," says the prophet, "who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a way that the redeemed could cross over?" Exodus 15, "The Israelites walked through the sea on dry ground." Psalm 77, "When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid, and the very deep trembled. Your way was through the sea, your path through the mighty waters, yet your footprints were unseen." I know you can see the connection here. Job chapter 9, "You stretched out the heavens, you, O God, trampled the waves of the sea." And now a confirmatory story. It's only in Matthew. It's wonderful. We're watching something extraordinary, and we could be sitting there watching it thinking, "Oh, Jesus can do that, but I can't." Wait a minute. Yes, we can. We can walk on water, just as Jesus does. We can go through the river dry shod. We can remain on the journey and trusting even when everything seems to be overwhelming us. Of course we can. And now you're going to watch it happen. This is about you and me. Peter said, thank God, "Lord, if it's you, command me command me to come to you, this is the point, on the water. He's not interested in walking on water, like he doesn't even think what he's doing. He's in the boat and he's a fisherman, he's at home. But he wants to go to Jesus. And he says, look, call me and I'll go to you, I want to go to you. And Jesus' answer to you and to me this morning and always is very simple. Come. Of course, come. So Peter gets out of the boat. He wouldn't have noticed himself doing that, I'm sure, in the story. It's kind of like the only way to get it to Jesus is to walk on water. So Peter got out of the boat and started walking, and he came towards Jesus. Beautiful. We've all done that. But this is the temptation and the danger. When he noticed the strong wind and became frightened, began to sink. So when he looked at Jesus, he was fine. When he looked in and thought, God, what have I done? What am I, where the hell am I? Where's the boat? He started to sink. And he yelled out to Jesus, Lord, save me. Save me. Redeem me. Hold my hand. Go with me, etc. Jesus immediately, of course, and he'll do it for you and me too, he immediately reached out his hand, caught Peter and said to him, oh, you little faith, why did you doubt? What made you think I would let you drown? And he grabs him and they got into the boat and the wind ceased. All that has been acted out on the stage. Why? Because it's remembered events? I don't think so. At least I can't make any sense of that as a remembered event. But it's a created scene that powerfully links us right back to the whole, the big story of, well, I've done it, Egypt, Red Sea, desert, Promised Land, all of that. And the Psalms are full of it, and the prophets are full of it, and we should be full of it too. And it's true. It's a powerful truth, but not a truth that you can put into little facts. A profound insight into what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. Each of us can walk on water. Each of us can feed 5,000, 10,000, 15,000. Don't limit it, because we don't know, and it's not our job to count it. Each of us can nourish each other because he is doing it in us. Now, I want to go through the whole of Matthew's Gospel with you. That's why I'm talking for so long. I'm now going to move fairly quickly, and forgive me, but otherwise we'll be here all morning. But I did want to do those two scenes as powerfully as I could and as accurately as I could to help you get a deeper understanding of a gospel. A gospel is not a poem. It's not a diary. It's a drama focused on Jesus. How do we tell people, this is Peter saying, how can I tell people what Jesus was really like? And often he can tell them by telling them what Jesus did. Of course that communicates powerfully. Facts are very important. But like Shakespeare, he can also create scenes that link up with all their ancient traditions and faith. Matthew 14:34 reads, when they'd crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret. After the people of the place recognized him, they sent word through the region, and they brought all who were sick to him and begged him that they might touch even the fringe of his cloak, and all who touched it were healed. The Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem, and they said, look, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? They don't wash their hands before they eat. Jesus answered them, "Why do you break the commandment of God for the sake of your traditions?" They're not tradition, but your traditions. God said, he criticizes them, he's trying to wake them up, wake us up. Honor your father and your mother. You know that, that's in the Torah. And it also says, whoever speaks the evil of the mother and father must surely die. But you, these are the, you say that whoever tells his father or mother, "Oh, look, sorry, mum, dad, the support you might have had, I've given it to God, I've set it aside for God, I've given it to the church, so it's kind of there, and so you don't have to give, you don't have to feed your parents anymore, look after them, because you've got this back thing, a religious." No, it says Jesus, "You hypocrites. You honour me with your lips, but your heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me," says God. Why? Because they're teaching human precepts as though they were doctrines. Excuse me. There's stacks of that around still, and we all have to work together gently. No, not harshly, but gently to improve that. Because in every church, in every group, in every country, in every bloomin' state, there are habits of behaviour that are kind of in there in the law. And they need to be cleared away. They need to be... Jesus called the crowd to him and said to them, "Listen, understand. It's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person." And you know that it's still there in Judaism, all the kosher food. You can eat this and you can't eat that. And go back to my childhood. We could have, I think it was 4.5 ounces of meat. That would be a venial sin on Friday. But if we had 5 ounces of meat, it was a mortal sin. Go to hell, putting it bluntly. God, whoever thought that up? I presume fishermen did. To get us to eat fish. No, I don't know. But whatever it is, it was crazy. And we've come to see through it. There's a lot more we have to see through. We have to let Jesus enlighten us through. No, he said, that what goes into your mouth doesn't defile you. It's what comes out of your mouth that defiles. Then the disciples approached and said to him, "Do you know that the Pharisees take offence when they heard what you said?" And he said, "Every plant that my heavenly Father has not planted will be uprooted. Let them leave them alone. They're blind guides leading the blind. And if one blind person guides another, both will fall into the pit." Peter said, "Look, explain what you're talking about to us." And then Jesus said, "Are you still without understanding? Don't you see that whatever goes into the mouth enters the stomach and goes out into the sewer? But what comes out of the mouth, what comes out of the mouth, proceeds from the heart. And this is what defiles. For out of the heart come evil intentions, murder, adultery, fornication, theft, false witness." These are the commands, the Ten Commands, you know them. "Slander. These are the things that defile a person. But to eat with unwashed hands doesn't defile." Jesus left that place and went away to the district of Tyre and Sidon. He's gone outside the Holy Land. It's a beautiful little scene, this one. Just then, a Canaanite woman — we haven't met people who aren't Jews at this stage, nor is Jesus, so, well, he might have, but even we don't hear about it. Just then a Canaanite woman from that region came and started shouting, "Have mercy on me, Lord, mercy." Wow, we're right at the heart of it all now. That's Jesus' ministry. She knows what words to use to... "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon." She's losing it. She's all over the place mentally. What's something going wrong? And I don't know what it is. Jesus didn't answer her. The disciples came and said to Jesus, "Look, send her away. She keeps shouting after us. We came up here for a bit of a break, and look, you've got all this going on. Look, do something." And look at Jesus' answer. Like, he'd love to help her. "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." That's what Jesus thought his mission was. When he prayed, that's what he heard. And that's what he's been doing. Doing what God wants. He didn't come to love. He came to give God's love. Which, of course, are connected. But he wants God's will, and that's what he thinks God's will is. "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But, thank God, she came and knelt before him and said, "Lord, help me." And Jesus said, look, it's not fair. He tries to make sense of how can you explain to her what he's discerned is God's will. "It's not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the little dogs." Everyone knows that's true. But she said, so he didn't get away with it. It didn't work. "Yes, Lord, but," and I'll give you the literal meaning of it in the Greek, "little dogs can eat the little crumbs that fall from the little children's table." There's three little littles in there. I've actually quoted Mark here, but anyhow, that she plays with this word little. And Jesus smiles, obviously. She's saying, "Help me." And she's come in, very clever. Jesus can't resist her. And he discerns something in prayer that's new to him, I suggest. It's new in the gospel anyhow. He realizes from this woman's behavior that what he thought God's will for him was not complete. God wants him to love everybody. It'll mostly be Jews because that's where he lives. But here's a beautiful scene of an outsider. "Woman," he says, "great is your faith. Let it be done as you wish." And the daughter was healed instantly. And then Jesus goes into Gentile territory because God has revealed to him through her a deeper level of his mission. God's done it to all of us, I'm sure. "He passed along the Sea of Galilee and went to the mountain. He sat down and great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the maimed, the blind, the mute, and many others. And they put them at his feet and he cured them. So that the crowd was amazed when they saw the mute speaking and the maimed whole and the lame walking and the blind seeing. And they praised the Lord of Israel." Then Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I have compassion on the crowd." And now we have a repeat of the scene that I did with earlier, and I'll take it as read. This is in Gentile territory, and there are, the numbers are different, and 7 is there and not 12, because 7 is a Gentile thing, and 12 is clearly a Jewish thing with the 12 tribes. So the scene is repeated. So what Jesus did for the Jewish crowd, Jesus is now doing for the Gentile world. And so we are. And it doesn't add anything substantial to what we've seen in that earlier. It's a repeat of the earlier scene in a new setting, which would have meant a lot to the people in Antioch, who were Jews and Gentiles. Chapter 16, the Pharisees and Sadducees came, and to test Jesus, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. We've heard about that already. And he answered them, "Look, when it's evening, you say it'll be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it'll be stormy today, the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky. Why can't you interpret the signs of the times? What are you asking me for signs for? Just look and get rid of your prejudices and your ideologies and your theological certainties. Look. An evil and adulterous generation asks for a sign. Well, okay, there will be a sign, but it'll be the sign of Jonah. Death, whale, 3 days, etc. And he went away. When the disciples reached the other side, they'd forgotten to bring any bread. This is a bit of a humorous scene in a way, but it's powerfully challenging too. And if there's a little bit of fundamentalism in any of you or in me, I hope this wipes it away. I hope we learn to read the Bible, not in a powerful way that we can control because we've got its meaning exact, but the way you listen to poetry and music and dancing and opera and all these lovely things that human beings do when their heart is engaged, and their mind as well, but not just the logic side of it, but the whole of our humanity, our rich humanity. Here we've got the disciples giving us a bit of a warning about that. Jesus, when the disciples reached the other side, they'd forgotten to bring any bread. Oh, that's all right. Jesus said to them, "Watch out, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." And they said, "Oh, it's because we haven't brought any bread." Jesus is saying to them, "Did you forget to bring the bread, you silly men?" And becoming aware of it, Jesus said, "Oh God, why are you talking about having no bread?" Yeast, see, was bread. "Why are you talking about having no bread? You talking about having no bread. Don't you perceive? Can't you see? Don't you remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000? How many basketfuls were you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000? How many baskets you gathered?" In other words, you're full of gifts. The church has all the grace it needs to carry on its mission in the world. A parish has all the leadership, all the qualities needed in a church or in every parish. They're all there. Plenty of stuff coming from God, because God's infinite. So all the gifts are there. Just look, recognize them, and then name them. "How could you fail to perceive," says Jesus. "I wasn't speaking about bread. Because of the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees, then they understood that he told them to beware of the yeast of the of bread, not of it, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees." And he's using a simple image, but they're locked into the literal meaning of the words. Now Jesus came to the district of Caesarea Philippi, and I've got a map there for you with a little arrow right at the top. It's as far away as you can get north in the Holy Land. And he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Well, some say it's John the Baptist." So their mentality is very different from ours. If you saw someone, you wouldn't think it was someone who was dead, who's come back to life. But they were quite capable of thinking of that. "Well, some say you're John the Baptist, come back. Others reckon you're Elijah, the prophet, the ancient prophet who's up in heaven, in the fiery chariot, and that's who you are. And others say you're Jeremiah, one of the prophets. And Jesus said to them, nice question for you to ask as you go into prayer. Stay in prayer, but just go into silence. Who do you say I am? Who is Jesus for me, for you? Who am I, says Jesus, for you? And Simon Peter answered, in some senses in Mark it's better, he just says, you're the Christ. It's very simple. And Luke's much the same. You're the Christ. You're the one my grandmother told me about when I was a little kid. You're the one I've been dreaming about. You're the fulfillment of the desires and longing and history of my people. You're the flowering of Israel. It's all in the word Messiah. It's a really strong word. But not the Messiah as understood by the leaders of the people who reckon he's going to be a high priest or he's going to be a military general getting rid of the Romans and all that stuff. But no, says Peter, you're the Messiah. And then in Matthew's gospel, it's opened up a bit. The Son of the living God. And Jesus said to him, Makarios, happy, blessed and happy are you, Simon, son of Jonah. Flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you, but my Father in heaven. It's in prayer, Peter, that you came to this insight of what the Messiah really is. Someone as simple, lovely, loving, like us in everything, but without sin. I tell you, you are Peter in the Greek Testament, Petros. On this rock, Petra, so it's clear in the Greek, and it is in Aramaic as well for that matter, but in English we haven't got that linguistic connection, but it's here. You're Peter, you're the rock, and it's on this rock that I'm going to build my church, my community, and the gates of, this is really important, the gates of Hades. We use the word hell in English. It's hopeless, really. We keep using the word hell for Gehenna and Hades, and they're not the same. Why our language is so poor, I don't know. This is the Hades is the underworld where the spirits of the dead Sheol in Hebrew and Hades in Greek. This is where those who've died, they exist but they don't live. Well, the gates of Hades will not prevail against this church. It's the first time the word's been used in the gospel, church. In other words, the church is on the attack. It's not on the defensive. It's not locking itself behind moats and castle walls and keeps and everything. No, the church has a mission to the world. And it's the world, it's the Hades that can't prevail against this love. It's all-powerful, it's amazing, it's stunning. And look at the history of the church. There are billions of Christians in the world. And this tiny little group where it started. And it will still continue to grow if we can learn to love. I'll give you, he says to Peter, the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. And those same words later, and I'll dwell on them there, the same words are said to the community. Yes, it's Peter, yes, whatever you bind. But he also says it to the whole community. So it's a lesson for all of us. From that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders and chief priests and scribes, be killed, and on the third day be raised. I'll have to say it briefly because of time. Sorry, I've gone so long, really. But on the third day is a technical word in the Bible. It goes right back to the book of Exodus, chapter 19, where God says on the mountain to Moses, tell the people to prepare, because on the third day, he says, the mountain, etc. I will. So the third day becomes the day when God reveals who God is. It's the day of revelation. Jesus, yes, first time we've heard this, he's going to suffer. In fact, he's going to be killed, but he'll be raised on the third day. Does that mean like Friday, Saturday, Sunday? No. It means he'll be raised in God's time when God reveals who God is. And that happens in the resurrection, of course. Peter didn't like that. And he took Jesus aside and began to rebuke him. He said, God forbid, Lord, this mustn't ever happen to you. But Jesus turned to Peter and said, get behind me, Satan. You're a stumbling block to me. You're setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things. Jesus told his disciples, look, if you want to be my disciple, deny yourself. That's not his final statement on it, but deny this ego stuff. Take up your cross. I wish you didn't have to, I wish you didn't have one, but life seems to present it. So take up your cross, says Jesus, and walk with me. Those who want to save their life will lose it. We've heard that before. And those who lose their life will save it. What will it profit you if you gain the whole world but forfeit your life? So when he says, deny your life, well, he doesn't mean your real life, because your real life is so important, your unique gift from God. So what's the point of getting the whole world if you lose that? What will you give in exchange for life? For the Son of Man is to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay everyone for what has been done. Truly I tell you, there are some standing here who will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And it's very similar to a statement we had earlier. And I'll finish now with music from Claire of Assisi.
Look upon his heart. to life's way, and with